investments in Vienna, that will assist us going forward with our work. Also to say that I think the committee secretary may need to take us at some point through our projected program up to next year's end of financial year. This is an issue about the budget, where we have to exhaust the budget and we're motivated for additional funds. For example, I've proposed that we look at the possibility of having another oversight visit. I'm not sure whether it would be to a province or to municipalities or national, etc. But those are issues that we can look at in future meetings as we review our program. Today we have the Deputy Auditor General and his team. You'd recall that, I don't know if I conveyed the fact that the Auditor General was available last week, but we couldn't meet because, amongst other things, I was at the Magistrates Commission. We're busy filling vacancies for regional court magistrates, about 30 vacancies this past 2 weeks, so it was quite hectic. And if you don't participate in one of the interviews, then you can't comment on the candidates because how do you compare them? So I had no choice but to be away last week, Friday. All right, so today we are going to deal with the SAT plan and budget. How far are we with the report on the annual report? What reports are still absent? Can you just quickly address us on issues of where our reports are?
Chair, the annual report is finished. The report on the annual report is finished. We are still busy just with one or two recommendations. Unfortunately, the researcher isn't around. But we will be able to give you something at our next meeting. And the other report would be the one that deals with that international trip in itself. We will be able to give you a draft next week on that.
And the report that we've adopted, report in full on all the reports?
The report on the oversight to Northwest and Etiquette is that has been adopted by the committee. Unfortunately, it has not been ATC'd yet, but in our section, they are busy with editing and so on. So it should be in by next week.
And the other issue? The general report. The general report.
Yes, the researcher also, I spoke to him yesterday. He has finished a draft report. But he says that he wants to show you the report first before he but he's finished with the draft of
the general report on the MFMA. Can
yes.
we make sure that before the end of the month, we try and finalize all or most of these reports so that as soon as possible they can be ATC'd and tabled before Parliament? This thing of reports being debated or discussed a year after they've been adopted makes the whole process irrelevant and, you know, irrational because the issues are so stale by then. All right, okay, colleagues, I don't know, AG, DAG, are you guys ready to kick off?
Yes, certainly.
And welcome with your team.
Yeah, I hope you have
your visit to Austria was worthy, and we look forward to also sharing some insights from yourselves after the visit to the site of the Secretary General of Intersci. Chair, today, as you indicated earlier, the Auditor General is busy on the roadshows. He says he has been crisscrossing about four provinces this week and finishing off with the Free State this morning. So he has forwarded his apologies for not being here today. Recently, Chair, we presented to yourselves our annual report, which was discussed and engaged with. And following from that, as part of our normal cycle, we normally then present a strategic plan. Then the one we are presenting on today, we will be reporting on it on the 31st of March 2014. So we are basically putting in place plans to continue the journey of implementation of the strategic plan that was tabled by the Auditor General when he took over in November of 2006. So we are, in essence, as an office, at the tail end of those five areas of commitment that Auditor General committed to deliver over these 7 years. And so the real essence of what is in our trust plan then is about taking stock largely of what we as an office had been doing over the past 6 years, and taking cognizance of the fact that there may well be a slight or big re-emphasis of certain areas beyond the term of this this 7 year plan that we are presenting now. So what we're going to be dealing with then, Chair, is predominantly a continuation of those same five themes. If we recall from our strategic plan that we have been working with over the years, the five key areas we have been focusing on as an office is one that deals with developing a message that is clear, simple, and relevant, and enables those that are charged with oversight to act on it. And the other goal that we also committed to, which we had been implementing and delivering on, is the one on the visibility to our stakeholders, as well as all our people being visible to engage with the institutions that we audit. And the third one has always been around making sure that as an audit office, I'm now on the page that says overview of the AGSA's commitment. The third one is a goal that deals with the funding of the office to ensure that the office is financially stable and that it has the necessary financial flexibility it requires to do and to expand on the areas that it commits to do. The fourth one as well is a recap again, Chair, the area of strengthening our human resources. As we had always said over the past 6 years, we had put specific focus on the area of ensuring that we develop and deepen our level of skill as an audit office so that we can rely on people who are able to report on the work that we do with the level of competence and technical capacity that is required to deliver on the broad mandate of the office. So that's the one other area which we continue to reflect upon in this strategic plan. The last one, Chair, in terms of the fifth goal is about ensuring that the stuff that we do as an office continues to be exemplary, continues to be work that is done in an environment that is unlikely to be questioned in terms of its reliability, in terms of the systems that have been put in place, as well as the development of a strong culture of ethics and performance, which is driven by strong levels of quality. So these are the five goals, Chair, in summary, that we as an office are continuing to reflect on in the strat plan. And as I said, this arose from a strat plan that became effective from 1 November 2006, and we are clearly at the tail end of it. On the next one, in terms of the key focus areas on this, we had set out in this strat plan, Chair, to increase our focus, among others, on the area of performance audits. We had undertaken over a number of years to deliver, in addition to our financial audits, the work that is required to go deeper than just examining financial information and compliance with financial prescripts. So the strategic plan that you will be going through, which will be effective March next year, talks about our commitment to increase the level of involvement in performance audits at least over the next 3 to 5 years to the extent of about 10% in total of our overall audit hours. So you will see in the document that we have articulated a journey in terms of how we're going to go forward with making sure that that 10% can at least be achieved. Just in terms of what is currently happening, even if it's prior to the strat plan we're dealing with, on the area of performance audits, we already are in the process of reporting on one of the key areas that we had focused on. This week we had been briefing chairs of various portfolio committees of those departments that are specifically involved with the performance audit that we did. And that performance audit is on evaluating economy, efficiency, and effectiveness of the use of consulting services in the broader public sector. And I think that if one looks at that particular performance audit, it largely resonates with some of the stuff that the Minister of Finance was talking about. In fact, it almost sounded like they had a little bit of an insight into some of the stuff that we were dealing with the chairs of this committee. So it was quite refreshing to see that we have picked a topic that is relevant for the time in terms of the emphasis on making sure that the delivery of services is done at the minimum level of cost, but with the maximum level of benefit achieved at the end of the spend that different government departments commit. So I'm sure once we complete the process in terms of the primary stakeholders, which is prior to the final tabling of that performance audit report, we hope we could have an opportunity to also share those observations in that report with SCOWIC. So we'll make note of that so that we can seek an audience to deal with some of those, because a lot of them are systemic issues. I'm sure they can benefit even members of this committee when they do their oversight. So we're going to see more of these, and there's more topics that in the background we're busy researching, and we think that there will certainly be an interest in this area, because not only does it deal with, as I said, finance matters, it also deals with a lot of issues pertaining to capacity as well as the timing of the implementation of programs. The area of focus, again, which we're paying full attention to here, is the area of starting to look at our investigations capacity as an office. And the stance that we took on this one was to say, typically we don't lend ourselves as a primary source of investigations if we think about the fact that there's other agencies that do that well, better than we can claim to do. So in terms of this one, we have said in the strat plan, we're not going to be putting a lot of resources into trying to build our investigations capacity. But what we're going to do, we're going to try and integrate the people that already have that experience so that they can sharpen our ability to do regularity audits. So in essence, the investigations area, if you look at our budget plan, is not going up because we're not anticipating that people will come to us to do certain maladministration investigations. Those things are normally done by the SIU as well as the public protector mainly. So we're not really going to be giving too much emphasis, but we will use that expertise to make sure that when we develop our plans to do the regularity audit, they incorporate some of the insights that would have come from a forensic audit angle. You'll note as well, in terms of the third bullet, the area that we highlighted in our annual report where we did not achieve according to our target was the slippage in the area of quality. And we had committed that in this third plan we are going to share some specific initiatives to increase the priority on improving the level of quality across the board as far as our audit reports are concerned. Another key focus area which also is contained in the strat plan is the debt collection, which we hope that we can have more insightful engagements to find a better way to increase the success in respect of debt collection. Once again, members will be reminded that there's a huge concentration of amounts owing by a number of municipalities, at least in provinces like the Northern Cape, Northwest, Eastern Cape, and Free State to a great extent. So we will need a lot of support required to ensure that we at least have the resources that we need to continue to do the audit work. On the human resource side of things, project management, in terms of the delivery on our own projects, we've recognized that even us, sometimes we struggle to do things the way we expect them to be done by others, but there's ongoing improvement focus on trying to develop internal project management capabilities in the office. The learning and development area, Chair, for a long time we've always relied on securing the services of service providers, but we took a view that over a period of time we need to bring into the institution now our learning and development capacity, because we've got 9 provinces and staff to the extent of about close to 3,000 who are part of our staff. So there's critical mass in our own environment for us to be able to develop our own people who develop this material, deliver it, and make sure that we reduce the reliance on outside providers. So we've got an intensive set of initiatives to build that internal ongoing learning and development focus. One of the things, for example, we support the staff members who are busy finishing their qualifying exam for qualifying as chartered accountants. We support members of staff as well who are on a journey to complete their studies as government auditors, as well as information system auditor initiative. So there's a lot of activity here which is about building the skills base as well as the capacity and the technical competence of our people, not only on the technical part of things, but also to develop their insights as far as growing as executives in the office, so that over a long time, I think this is the plan, we ought not to be advertising every second week when there are vacancies, but we need to be knowing that we've got insufficient technical resources internally to move into various positions. And so we think that the journey that we've been on over the last couple of years has allowed us the opportunity to have space to invest in our own technical capacity, because the same people that we train, as well as the people that we grow over time in the office, ultimately end up in other public sector institutions, either as chief financial officers, or even if they went to the private sector. But I think what we are doing is part of what ought to be done to invest in the skills, especially in the area of finance, in the area of auditing, and risk management and governance. So for us, it's not even a question of are you going to retain all of them, as long as we know that those that we will deal with in the future in some of the public entities would at least have a better sense of what is required to strengthen oversight and governance in the public sector. We've also, Chair, in the same threat plan, articulated our plans. As we had reported, we started reporting on an integrated reporting basis in our annual report, where we shared with the committee what it is that we are doing to try and save on some of the things that are consuming environmental resources, things like paper usage and measuring and managing things like travel and so on and so forth. So this is just part of the early stages of building a sustainability profile, but here we have identified specific initiatives that we will do, where if we travel, because travel is an intensive part of what we do because of the physical access to our stakeholders, we will measure those and start putting on our annual report what our assessment of carbon footprint, among others. You know, we're still learning in terms of what this means on a day-to-day basis, but we know that if we travel to a particular place where we could have used teleconference facilities in the office, if we want to communicate with somebody in the Eastern Cape, we don't have to burn jet fuel. We can do it from this side of the office with somebody that's sitting in East London, and there will be no evidence of any carbon footprint if we handle our business like that. So this is part of a strategy to try and contain the extent to which we spend, but at the same time we have a line of sight into what benefits this could bring, even if we said it was 1 out of 1 million people that travel, at least it can make a small difference at the start.
So that's effectively, Chair, if I said we could have an early break and go and relax for the weekend, I would have said I would have said the rest of what I have in this presentation is meant to enhance the things that I've already spoken about. So, Chair, short of risking to go into the detail of this, I don't know if I should pause here and see after we have had a preliminary engagement whether there's any need to pay particular emphasis on any of the further slides.
Now, I'm going to allow that interval because the engagement might just direct the further engagement, which areas to put greater emphasis, as you said. So, did I interrupt you or saying something else?
I was saying, Jeff, cognizant of the fact that there's a second round of engagement that we will have where at that point we would have gone through the detail, members would have been able to read through the documentation as well. So I'm making that suggestion with that in mind.
Yeah. Colleagues, those are the broad strokes for the envisaged plan. I don't know whether you want to make initial inroads. Yes, Honorable Whip.
Chairperson, just two questions. One is around the issue of the ground. I just want to establish from the AG's office whether the current programs are higher, is that are not relevant, policy related, because the type of work that is done by government is advocated in our communities, find that it's similar to constructing work. And I would assume that in a certain account of the policy, the very nature of their training,
wouldn't be able to say when it comes to issues of performance audit, this is value for money, whatever. So I just want to understand whether you are busy acquiring certain skills, whether it's in the engineering field, project management field, to be able to assist, complement auditors when they do performance audit. The last question, Chairperson, is around the issue of investigation. I also just want to establish whether you'd be, I think we did discuss this thing at one point, but I just want to establish whether you are happy or satisfied that the SIU and public protector would have the necessary skills, for instance, to go into issues of finance, or it would be a matter of using the skills that are in the AG's office to be able, for them to be able to carry on their work. Because my concern that there are some tendency to find that people would refer matters to the public protector, the SIU, but it's not really their competence when it comes to issues of finance. The people would be much more knowledgeable about issues of finance would be the AGS office.
Honorable,
thank you, Chair. Mine is on the issue of the debt collection. I think this has been going on for some time now. It would be interesting to get a view, an overall view, as to whether there is an improvement in the list. Yes, the debt might not be taken away overnight, but is there an improvement? Because I think this has been going on since 2009 that you've been reporting this, that provinces are owing you and monies are not coming back. But I don't know if you also deliberately mentioned the particular provinces you mentioned to indicate that they are still in the red, but there is an improvement. It would be interesting to actually see if there is an improvement, since there are reports that there are some municipalities that are actually improving their audit status. Then the other issue, Chair, is an issue of more on the performance audit as well. Without repeating myself, to say you gave an indication that you've given a report to portfolio committees, but a lot of issues that are cross-cutting even to other committees, I think, would be of advice that when we have our cluster meetings, that there should be a more collective type of a report where we can all participate in, so that various views or indications or areas of interest, rather, in each of those portfolio committees can be shared with the AG to try and get these cross-cutting issues coordinated and ensuring that we are actually all in a way on oversight as to where there will be problems in terms of performance and improvements. Because I'm saying this because with, in particular with my committee on mineral resources, there was an improvement in terms of the audit results, but you find a possibility of regression. Now, unless we do that in coordination to see to it that issues of regressions are handled, talking to each other, I think we could still encounter problems. Yes, it's fine, chairpersons have been given that opportunity, but I think it should be opened up to the broader floor of members to be able to have better inputs to improve the area of performance.
Other? Yes, Mr. Geneva.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I just want to get clarity under the section on key overhead drivers. Is this figure right here for 6.850 million rand for AG's farewell celebration?
Page 38,
Chairperson.
All right. Any other points? Is that it? All right, yes. Honourable Tyson.
Avoid putting our phones on the table because the entire table vibrates. I mean, if somebody's phone even if it's on silent, sometimes if it's on the table, it causes the whole table to vibrate. Sorry for interjecting, interrupting. Please, no, proceed. No, that's fine. All right.
I just want to congratulate the AG for seeing the bigger picture and saying we are South Africans and we don't just look at our office, but we are looking at the whole country. You know, if we could have many of us seeing things that way, I think this country would go very far. On the issue of the of debt collection, I think, Chair, in the last discussion, we said we should intervene as a committee. We should actually have a session with Treasury so that we discuss different ways of dealing with this, so that the Auditor General is left to do what he is supposed to do, not to be bogged down by trying to collect fees from municipalities who do not have those fees anyway. So I would suggest that we deal with that issue in that manner. The other one was the investigation that the Auditor General is saying there are SIU and the Public Protector. I sit in another portfolio committee.
Justice.
No, no. Intelligence. Where people came to report on financial issues. And my response to them was that I would not be satisfied with what they had done unless if they show me the stamp of the Auditor General on my desk, because I was not convinced that is the way they should have, that is the figure they should have come out with, or the way in which they have investigated. So I'm trying to support the honorable member that, you see, in this country, the authority that has got the capacity to pronounce on a financial matter is the Auditor General. I have been a bookkeeper in the private sector for 17 years, and I used to challenge suppliers and even SARS to say, unless if I see the signature of an auditor, I would not be happy with the estimates that they gave, because I had arrived at a different figure, which I was convinced was more correct than theirs. And I really dealt with more than 20 cases with that, and I won all of them because of that. So I'm convinced that the Auditor General is the final person to announce all figures. They can investigate other things, but not figures, because you see, they don't have the skills to do that. Maybe we would talk about coming to an agreement with them on what they are going to do and what you are going to do. But for them to say they are going to investigate figures, I don't know if... I don't know. I'm not going to...
Thank you. All right. Can I just throw in one or two from my side? Firstly, the issue that Mustol has just raised now ties in with another question. I was, for example, approached by one service provider, ODT, who said that a portfolio committee is demanding a special audit on a specific issue as part of their to complete their oversight on that specific issue. And the ODT was saying that they don't mind going through that process, but who's going to pay for the audit, because they budget for audit fees on the basis of, I suppose, the minimum audit requirements, which say that every audit team must subject themselves to the normal audit process. And the issue came across as they need to clarify who can request special audits. Can either auditees or portfolio committees require of the Auditor General over and above their normal audit responsibilities to suddenly embark on a special audit? Because the way it came across, such an audit would have to be done by the institution of the Auditor General, whether they subcontract or whatever. Then the other issue is the investigations, performance audits, regularity audits. Can we reach a stage where these things can be a seamless and a single function, or we have to live with the fact that for now we are primarily focusing on regularity audits, gradually we will factor in performance audits, and as and when it becomes absolutely unavoidable, we'll do investigations. What informs whether we will be able to do the one or the other? Is it issues of capacity? Is it issues of organizational development that has to be allowed to happen gradually until it reaches a point? Or is it issues of, for example, the reality that as a country, we're still having too many regularity, negative audit outcomes, such that it will take us time to go past a stage where we can say regularity audits are now a given. We no longer focus much on those. We're now into performance audits because of the level of growth or development in our compliance levels within amongst our auditees. And also just in terms of our leading by example, it might help us if you sing a few praises for yourselves about some of your achievements so that we get to know that as well. Because these things are important. I mean, we get to hear that South Africa is leading with regards to I don't know whether we're in the number one spot or as a supreme audit institution in the world, and if we are, how long have we been thus far? What sustains us in that spot? What measures are we taking to retain that spot? And there could be other accolades that we might not be aware of. I think it would be good if those kind of positive feedbacks are shared by with the committee as well. Maybe I should pause there because we're overloading the round. Over to you, DAG. This one, I think, I would also want you to deal with the coordination of work that a colleague referred to between yourselves. You mentioned SIU and public protector. How coordinated is that coordination? In the sense that have the demarcation of response or allocation or sharing of responsibility been so clarified that we don't have too many gaps of areas that remain unattended between the different, you know, chapter 9s and related institutions?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the honourable members for the questions. Let me start with the one that came from the latter pages, the one that deals with the AG Bewell. That's the easier one to remember because it's all on the page. The issue here that was put on the budget 2014, honourable member, arises from our recognition that the AG's term is a non-renewable term, and therefore by the end of November of next year he will be doing something else. So we kind of said, look, over this period it may be a worthy thing to do, but this amount you're looking at here is not in our view huge, in the sense that we've incorporated the stuff that the AG does every year. For example, when he goes next year to present the Municipal Finance Management Act audit findings, which is an activity that normally happens around February, March, you know, the same road shows that the AG does now, he will be doing the same set of those when he reports on municipalities next year. So what we've factored in our budget is an engagement or a session with those stakeholders, because he will be seeing the municipalities for the last time in his term then, and therefore that's what we factored. So it's linked to the ongoing work. It's not a separate town hall activity that has got millions of people in it. It's just really the fact that you recognize there will probably be an extra financial cost where we call on the stakeholders to say, Mr. Nombembe has been on this journey over the past 7 years, and this is just part of saying until next time type of thing. And of course there will be one where there will be national stakeholders to recognize his end of term and so on and so forth. So if one looks at it in terms of the per capita expenditure, it's really something that we believe is worthy of doing. As far as the other questions, if I may start with the Honorable Chief Whip's questions on the program for skills, you'll see, honourable member, that in our narrative in the strategic plan, we have clearly demonstrated how we're going to climb this journey. We recognise, as you do, that this is not your traditional terrain for accountants. We are going to embark on a number of combination of initiatives. Let me say, there will be those people that we attract to come internally into our office, who have got that variety of skills other than financial and accounting skills. We will also partner, and we've already done that. We're just about to finalize signing an MOU, for example, with the CSIR, among others. And the reason for it, we know, is because the bulk of the staff that's going to require a lot of the performance audit work is also in the area of road infrastructure and many other infrastructure projects. So the route that we are taking is to partner with the relevant institutions, but at the same time to insource those skills in the meantime that we may not have on board. So we do recognize that this, certainly as we grow this to a significant double-digit portion of our hours, we're going to need statisticians, as an example, who will come and analyze the statistical data that we're going to be looking at. We will require people who are program evaluators with that kind of orientation as well. So the more we get into this thing, the more we know that there is a need to broaden the variety of skills. So what's contained in the document is also an articulation of that plan. And we know that it's something, as we grow the delivery of work, we will also need to focus on how do we bring on board the capacity we need. And the trick with it is that it's risky to bring that capacity fully on board, because you'll then absorb a fixed cost that will only be busy for a portion of the period. Because then the problem becomes, how then do you get rid of those people? Say, for example, we were doing a performance audit on infrastructure, and then we do it and we finish it. And if you had those people on board physically working for us, it will mean that we must consider exit plans and that type of stuff, should we have completed that as well. So the approach we're taking is that let's have a base of those that have got that variety of skills as part of our team in the performance audit, but we will partner with the combination of external agencies and so on and so forth. And the way we do that, because we've got issues of independence that we need to protect, we always evaluate whoever it is that we're going to partner with. We always evaluate them from the point of view of being independent and not being conflicted if they are going to provide input to us. Let me make an example. The other day we were reflecting on one of the topics that we are thinking of, which are about rural development, agriculture, and so on. And we said maybe we must partner with a specialist agricultural economist to help us in the stage of doing the research around the topic of performance audit, so that we can understand the meaning of some of the programs that are sitting in areas like rural development. So it's that kind of approach. Then once we engage that service of an expert, let's say for 6 months to help us research the topic, we will also put in place a plan for guidance, so that when we get the data, we interpret it and we report on it. We do not do it without consideration of certain unique technical expertise that we may not possess. So the strategy then is to say, let's not have them on board permanently, because it will be too costly to keep them. They won't be busy every day. However, we can tap into those resources as and when we need it, so that we can convert that which could have been a fixed cost into a manageable variable cost. So that's the plan in terms of the scaling part of it. If I can just maybe take that part of the question and link it with Honorable Masuta's question regarding the capacity, is the issue of moving towards a single seamless audit prospect. My sense that it is, but there are still hurdles on the way to get to that. I think it is a prospect. What we are talking about in the second bullet, when we talk about integrating performance audit investigations and regularity audits, what we're saying is that while we have these teams separate, the guys who do a regularity audit are driven by financial year-end considerations. So you can't do an audit until you have completed a year-end, which is the end of March. Whereas a performance audit, you can do at any stage. You can do it in or outside of a financial year. And investigations is a reactive engagement, which you respond to on the basis of somebody requesting it. So we've got all of these three elements of it sitting separately for now. But what we've done is, in the integration, is to say, let us pick up some of the key issues that we pick up on a performance audit and share them with the guys who are in regularity audit. Let's say, for example, we auditing in performance auditing, and we are doing an audit of infrastructure, the delivery of infrastructure in schools and hospitals and health facilities, the one that we reported on last year. What we've done in terms of an example of integration with that was to say, what were the key themes that came out from that performance audit that we did? The answer was a lot of issues in terms of failure of supply chain to be done properly. Another one was failure of the effective execution of that which was delivered. For example, a school is standing, but there's no furniture and there's been no budget for teachers to come and teach at that school. So the school has been delivered in terms of the physical structure, but nothing happens. What was intended to be the objective of building the school is not being achieved because there's no money set aside for teachers or furniture or learning material. So what lessons we picked up there was then to say, now that we've picked up these issues in a performance audit, because we dived deeper when we examined it from a performance audit, let us pick up these issues and share them with the regularity auditors, the guys who will go and do the financial year-end audit, to say, please be on the lookout for these type of risks to see if they have been addressed, following on the recommendations we would have made at the time of completing the performance audit. And the strategy about that is to say, rather you don't spend too much more time evaluating the same issues that we've already picked up. So we are trying to integrate them. So the long-term view then, Chair, to answer that question as to whether we will then have a single and seamless audit, is then to start migrating over a period of time to a situation where we can handle all of these types of audits as one set of report in the future. So the point, I think, is that there's a developmental journey that we need to go through before we can get to that point. Part of it is about having the right skills, because once you have a combination of statisticians, economists, and data analysts, and program evaluators, and accountants, and stuff like that, and then the other one says, no, but the international standard on auditing of this matter says A, B, and C, and so you can actually have a very confused set of issues to deal with, because the other one is regulated, another one is predominantly program evaluation. But I think there are opportunities to get them to a one platform, it's just that the journey has not allowed us yet to get to that.
Somebody said, but in this world of technology, why don't you just use GPS to establish whether a school that is claimed to have been built physically there or not? But I guess the school might actually be there, but with a lot of cracks in the foundation in such bad state that it must be demolished, or the road is so potholed or potentially potholed that it's not worth, even though it's physically there. But anyway, it's just an aside.
Thanks. Okay, so that's the game plan, I think, as far as performance audit is concerned. And I think as we articulate the consolidation of this strat plan, some of those points that I think you've raised will certainly be of consideration, because if you look at other established Supreme Audit institutions, they do have, many of them, for example, have a huge orientation towards performance audits, but they still continue to ring-fence the regularity audit side, because that is a statutorily determined process which requires at a particular point for a report to be released. In the U.S., as an example, the almost 80% of their resources are towards program evaluation of government programs, and they keep about 20% of their resources for regularity audits. And the way their system has matured, as it were, in terms of the way they do things there, they won't go to every single agency, which is effectively the equivalent of departments here, to do regularity check. They'll do a consolidation and say that the total X trillion dollars of rent spent in this year were in these categories, and they just do spot checks on them and so on. So ours have not developed to that level. I think the point you made earlier regarding, is it a factor of the state of development of our, you know, capacity also in the public sector? It could well be, because while you're busy with the challenges that we see in regularity audits, the question could be, how do you know that the data following the numbers that have not been properly handled is also accurate? And we know the answer in many instances, that in terms of the audit of performance objectives, we are still having challenges in terms of accurate reporting of performance information as well. So I think it's an opportunity to think about how do we migrate to that single platform while we have all these challenges, because I think there's also a view that it's not going to help to wait for all of these things to be cleared, because they may never be cleared in a lifetime. But also the other perspectives, Chair, that we've considered was to say, if you know already that the system is not as reliable as you wish it could be to be able to venture into areas like performance audit, would it not be better to enhance focus on internal audit, so that if you do internal audit checks on each of the departments and you can satisfy yourself that they are well run internally in terms of internal controls, then you can ignore the fact that they did not report accurately on their numbers, because the internal audit will give you comfort that at least things are accurate as far as they are being reported. And I think that's another area that we have flagged, but I'm sure it will come further down the line to say, how can we enhance focus on internal audit capacity in government as a way of accelerating performance audits.
I think, well, there's internal auditors also, isn't it, in all the departments. Perhaps one of the issues should be that in our, especially on our side, in terms of departments coming to report to Parliament, an initiative should come up of some sort that audit committees, or at least chairpersons of audit committees, should also have a system of reporting to us through the department, so that we can get an indication beforehand already as to where problems could arise and to avoid what I was talking about earlier on regression. But also from the Auditor General side, it must be an issue of saying the next time we come and audit a particular department, then there would have been a regular reporting from the internal audit committees, which could also be a way of cutting costs in terms of you having to go to them, because most of the work would then would have been done accurately for that matter, and in enough confidence to can say that the information that you have is accurate. And we don't have a situation in Parliament, I think, where when we call departments, we are specific to say audit committees should also have their share of coming to report directly to us. As a preventive measure.
In energy, we do.
In energy? Oh, well, you one up. We don't in mineral resources, but it should be an issue that should be highlighted, because normally you just call the CFO, and the CFO would give a general report, but the underlying issues of the internal issues that you're complaining about as far as auditing is concerned are not normally identified on time.
I'm also going to take Honourable Stan Aizen, because I think he also wanted to chip in.
Chief, just to follow up on my question there, and thanks very much for the answer.
Well, can we, before we get back to it, just check if there's still some follow-ups on this one? Because I also have this feeling, and okay, you'll come in as well, that it seems as if the issue of independence of internal audit structures is critical then for reliability and dependability for us to recognize them as the Supreme Audit Institution. Well, not to recognize them, but to recognize their work without having to double-check audit even the work of the internal auditors, because if you have internal auditors and when you come and do the audit, you still uncover things that should have been uncovered by the internal audit system, what does it tell you? It raises questions about the integrity and credibility and dependability of that system. Then perhaps we need to talk about how do we strengthen that internal audit mechanism to ensure that once an internal audit has been done, there isn't any more need, and we can with confidence say we've done the audit for all intents and purposes. We don't need to go back unless under exceptional circumstances. It would also save a lot of costs and issues of duplication and so on. But it seems as if we are far from getting to that stage of development, and that's really something we may need even in our recommendations to go back to. I have the whip, and then Mastole, I suppose, on this issue as well.
No, to mine is just a minor addition to what the Honourable said. So, what was saying. In the Energy Committee, we do call the chairperson of the Audit Committee to share with us their views on the existence of internal control and the issues of the internal audit. And the frequency of their meetings is, but it's still at its
infancy.
Yeah.
Even outcomes of those actual audits, do you get that as well? All right. Honourable Sol.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, Chairperson.
Sorry. Double barrel.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to say, you know, on the question of internal audit, we must remember we're just 18 years into this democracy. People didn't know anything about audit. It was a closed sphere, totally closed. So we have them in the name of internal auditors. But people are not skilled, you know. So for us as South Africa, we a point where we can say we can cut costs by relying on the report of internal auditors.
Mm.
What we can be talking about is how do we develop that skill in government. When you talk about municipalities, you can even forget that. You don't have people who can go anywhere near that. It's maybe in the metros. But where I come from in Bushbuck Ridge, I don't know. Yeah, it's impossible. Not that people are not willing to do, not that people are not very intelligent, but it was a closed door.
I think if we were to ask a special report as this committee, a special audit would be an audit on internal audit institution to say where are we, you know, so that we can make very concrete recommendations specifically around that capacity, because I think if it was fully functional and capacitated, a lot of the problems, generally speaking, would be mitigated. But there you are, AG. Let me allow you to respond to this specific area, and then I'll go back to Honourable Stine Hazen's issue.
Oh, Chair, do you want me to reflect on the additional inputs, or do I just carry on with the rest of the other questions?
Or maybe, in fact, let me allow Honourable Stine Hazen, and then you can respond to everything and proceed.
Chief, thanks very much. Thanks very much for the answer there, and as I see, you're going to obviously include it with existing expenditure. And that brings me to the point I want to. I just wonder, what is the status of this document?
That's work in progress. This year, we're in now, we are
using that. Okay. Okay, so, because for instance, here under liaison, you've got 17.791 million, but in the document before stated, it's got 36 million here. So I just want to know, does that increase here include this additional expenditure for the AG's farewell, or is this included in the globular figure here for 36?
I think what is going to help if we maybe just ring-fence the area that deals with funding, it would be fine if we just deal with it comprehensively, because I'm not too sure which column we are referring to in this one. But we can help with the areas that are growing in the coastline. Let me just say that in terms of that...
Yeah, in all fairness, I think the initial idea was that we're just dealing with broad strokes in this first round, and then we're going to allow you the second round where you go into the detail, which would include detail on the financial projections, and then would have the next round. Yeah. So maybe let's deal with it that way.
Where was I? Okay. Now I've dealt with the issue of performance audits, and the report that we referred to, the one which we said we had reported to the chairs of the committees. What we've done up to now was just to brief them. Let me just clarify that part, because we were briefing them so that by the time we table this performance audit report, at least they are aware of what is it that is contained in it, so that they don't pick it up when it's already on the table. So in essence, then, Honourable Member, the report, once it is tabled, it will become available to Parliament, and then Parliament will refer it to those committees or that committee that needs to process it and so on. But if an opportunity arises for us to engage with any of the portfolio committees on it, we will gladly welcome it. One of the things that we are still going to check with the chair of committees in Parliament is the need to have a meeting with the chairs of committees as well, so that we can give them a brief, because we didn't do all the departments in the performance audit. We did about 8 out of the 20 or 30 odd national departments, but we wanted to give the generic flavor of what's come out of that report to all of them, and I'm sure that's going to happen maybe in the beginning of November before we go and table the report, which is expected around the middle of November. Investigations. The nature of the investigations that we do, among others, are very reactive. And we've noticed that our experience since 2008, I think, we started seeing a decline in the number of investigations that were referred to us. If members recall, a lot of the proclamations, for example, that the president signed, particularly with municipalities, on all sorts of issues that needed to be investigated, were referred to the SIU, among others. So the ability to control the work that flows to us is very tricky for us, because it's always dependent on the institution that originates the investigation as to where they want that investigation done. And I remember when we were doing something in the Western Cape, or we were being approached to do a supply chain management investigation in the Western Cape last year sometime, there was a lot of hassling as to whether we do possess the necessary technical competence to do that which was required versus people who are investigators in the true sense. So I think there's always that hassle. Now the trick that we're having is we don't want to get into a situation where we try and build up an investigations capacity, but the only way that it can be effective is if somebody makes a decision to say, I want an investigation. And investigations are not the flavor of the month all the time. There's a period in time in the cycles where they become a big thing, and then there's a period in time in the cycle where they just do not exist. And I suppose in peace and quiet times there will probably be less of those, and when there's a rough and rumble there will probably be more of them. So we can't be building capacity on the basis of those peaks and troughs that are so unpredictable. So that's one issue, and I think that it's a response to but Chair, just to add and to close with this one on the investigations, what does happen in practice is that if, for example, the public protector wants to embark on an investigation and they know that they do not possess in their ranks people who have a specific knowledge of a particular area from a financial management point of view, they'll call on us to work with their team so that we can bring that which they do not have. And so we do the same with them as well. If there's something that we need to deal with and we know we don't have the necessary depth of up-to-date legal interpretation issues, because some of those things, they trip us, because ours is predominantly following the dollar, you know, whether it goes to a debit or a credit and all of that. But then with them, they now have to drill down to start doing issues of interpretation of the meaning of a particular clause and those kind of issues, things that ourselves are very light on. So I think there's that approach to say, let's rather collaborate to reinforce the gaps that we have among ourselves. And we drive this through an existing MOU. Each one of the Chapter 9 institutions that exist, we have an MOU with. And we, for example, if I think about the IEC, when the IEC gears up for the five-year cycle election, they will call on us to assist them in tightening some of the processes from an oversight and governance point of view, because they know that we do have that expertise to try and create a system around the stuff they do. The same thing with the Office of the Public Service Commission. If they're going to do any of the normal investigations that they do, whether it's on vacancies, whether it's on any other issue, they will share it with us, because we trip on the same issues ourselves when we look at issues of root cause analysis and so on. So there is that level of sharing and interaction driven by existing MOUs. So that's for the Chapter 9, so that's for the SIU, the Public Protector, the coordination of work of those institutions. I think that's what I was covering. Internal audit capacity, Chair, I think that issue is relevant, and I'm glad that the Chair is proposing that something concrete needs to be developed around this. Because the one area that we've also been examining as we looked at this strat plan was the combined assurance model, to say that the primary level of assurance that needs to come in the work that we do in terms of oversight of institutions, strengthening financial management capacity and performance management, sits with management largely. So it's the accounting officer of the department that must make sure that they have the right people in the right jobs to produce accurate information. And on the side, they ought to be using effectively internal audit. And I think that the issue with internal audit, it probably hasn't grown to the level where all of us wish it could have been by now. I mean, there are some municipalities probably worse compared to national departments, you still, I mean, there was one municipality we went to where the internal auditor, who is obviously employed as part of management, they kind of interpreted their role as that of taking minutes of the discussions around around the financial statements, because it was an internal unit in a far-flung municipality with two people. The one is the internal audit manager, and then there's a person who's an assistant. So when they were producing their financial statements for the end of August submission in that year, and we asked for the file with the evidence of engagements of the internal audit, and it was clear that this was a set of minutes that were a record of the discussions that were happening around financial statements. So you've got that one level extreme, and you've got the other extreme that's about doing the actual evaluation and pushing back to management on issues that may not be sound financial control. So clearly, I think if this could be, I hope that that municipality has moved on from that, which was a situation about 3 years ago. So it is indeed a focus area, because it could help. It could help with a lot of things. It could reduce the extent of costs that we incur. It could reduce the extent of reliance on that work. But also it could bring the effectiveness of the audit committee into much sharper focus. Because the audit committee sometimes, because they are very busy people, many of them, they go to meetings hoping that everything is in place. But when they get there, they can already see that it requires them as audit committee members now to spend a lot more time trying to fix stuff for the institution. So I think the weakness of internal audit does put a lot of pressure in other oversight mechanisms, because it should be at least the last line of defense coming out of the ranks of management. By the time it goes to the audit committee, and by the time it goes to the MPEC or the auditor general, at least we should have some assurance that somebody independent who has got the necessary expertise has signed off on the financial statements. But Chair, if you could make a pronouncement on that one, certainly it will make our journey a lot lighter.
I think we'll just need more details.
We can share it with you. We do have that. We do make an assessment. That's why many of them, they complain. They say we come there and we say their internal audit work is not going to be relied upon. And then they get cross with us because they say we get too busy every year we are busy doing this thing here, and you come here once and you tell us that you're not going to rely on us. So kind of they take it personal, as if you are reflecting on their personal competence, whereas that's not the point. The point is what you've done does not add any additional level of assurance to what we must look at. So that's really the message that we're giving to you.
Coordinating work as a team, instead you are seen as an enemy when you come into a department. But also then I would ask the question, do you then have I don't know if I should call it a standard way of approaching the department for them to be able to prepare themselves for your coming in, or do you just walk in, because it could also be...
First, to the experiences that we had on oversight, where there is a whole lot of series of engagement and preparation leading up to the actual audit. Of course, there are a whole lot of time, but I'm not attempting to preempt your response. I'm just saying the experience that we had was that there is a lot of effort into, you know, where you give them a checklist even to say these are the areas in simple language which even I can understand on which we expect you, you know, to really either focus your bookkeeping and all other things, or expect the actual audit process to focus on. So people are pre-warned, but still that doesn't seem to change the situation. But anyway, it's your job to respond that.
No, Chair, certainly we, in the preparation process, in fact, the reason, among others, we say we do our audits based on international standards on auditing, it's about observing the key steps
part of which is communication with the auditee on a regular basis, even before the audit starts. Starting right from the planning stages up to final execution of the audit, we do interact with them. And in fact, internal auditors, it's normally the way that this thing about relying on internal auditors is meant to achieve technically, is that if, as an auditor, let's take an example, I'm going to be auditing the DBSA, as an example, and I know that at the DBSA there's a total expenditure of 100 million, for argument's sake, and I design my tests in the background, and I say to myself, there's an area in the DBSA that's responsible for funding municipality infrastructure, as an example. If I go there and I look at the programs that they implement, which are all over the country, I would imagine, in terms of the assessment of the creditworthiness of the municipality, the ability of the municipality to generate cash flows to pay the debt. If I go to that department at DBSA and I look at what management has produced and I confirm that the internal auditors who are, as a unit, reporting directly to the chair of the audit committee, but administratively to the CEO of the DBSA, as an example, which means that for all purposes of employment and matters of performance management, as well as producing the results, the internal audit reports to internal management. However, for purposes of highlighting matters that may require attention outside of the level of the executive, reports to the audit committee. So our starting point is to say, you now have the basis from which we as an audit office can evaluate the work that you are doing, because you now have a line of independence that goes to an audit committee that is on its own an independent group of non-executive people. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, once we've done that, we can say there's a basis to rely on this work. But the reliance we are talking about is to say, instead of looking at the whole 100 million then, we know that your structure, the way that you are brought about, can give us some level of comfort about the accuracy of these numbers, even if you didn't redo the work that you are doing. That's what reliance is about. So what it then does, it forces us to, instead of looking at the whole 100 million, to make a judgment call that, in fact, it probably is only worth looking at the other 70 instead of the full 100. That's what reliance on internal auditors is about, because it says the chances are that if internal auditors have done their work professionally and executed it in accordance with the international standards on auditing, they would have mitigated any risks associated with the full 100 million. So for us then to not duplicate the cost, let us take our level of assurance to a lower level, because we can pick up an element of assurance from the internal auditors to build onto our one. Why we say this is because we know that we have an experience of the intent of the audit committee taking very strong steps to deal with issues of witness. That's the history. So it's a combination of things. So obviously if somebody is an internal audit and they want us to rely on it, when we know that they were just attending minutes and editing financial statements and so on and so forth. Absolutely. So then we'll say, sorry, we'll have to look at the full 100 million because there's nothing we can rely on in terms of what you've done. So that's really the essence of that issue. And we can share with you, Chair, the evaluation we've done. We do it every year and we report on it in the financials of the entities to say we didn't place reliance on it. Well, to place reliance is about reducing our level of assurance from what they've done. All right. I hope I didn't get too technical on that, because this thing just came to my head. Thank you very much. Then, as far as the aging of the debt, we will bring that report. If we need to bring it for the next engagement, we can certainly share it. Honorable member, I don't have a specific sense of what the aging. Maybe the CFO can comment on it at the point when he deals with the financial chapter of our strat plan. Just to flag what our experience over time has been, at least over a 2-3 year projection, what it has been in terms of reduction of that debt. Can you please, Raj, prepare for that when I finish?
Maybe you could even touch on, I don't know if you would be ready to deal with that, an evaluation of the funding model to say what is the state of health of the current model, given the fact that this is not the only model to be followed. But if it's something a bit more dedicated, then we can always look at it differently at a different level.
Maybe on that point, Chair, even though we may not have anything prepared for it, perhaps I think it may be, from a timing point of view, it may be a good thing to perhaps flag on the agenda to look at, among others. Because if one looks at the committee that precedes this one, one of the very last projects they dealt with was an evaluation of the funding model, which is the one that is currently on the table. And I think also in the context of this threat plan being the final end of what current AG had committed to, it may be a good idea to put that item on the table. And perhaps for us it may just involve resurfacing the submissions that we had made to the previous COEC and updating that document with our experience to date for the last 3 to 4 years, so that in preparation for the future beyond November 2013, there can be an elaborate engagement, at least under the auspices of the current committee as well as the tail end of the current start plan. That could perhaps be a way to resurface it. So that at least when we look at the issue of the overall funding of the office, we look at it both in terms of the key strategic elements that need to be considered, whether there's a departure from the existing one or not is a different matter, but at least there will be enough to put on the table to comprehensively deal with it. Absolutely. Absolutely. We had presented all of those options, in fact, in the previous committee. So the option that we have now was the more popular one. But those other two options, which was about a full appropriation option or a hybrid of full part appropriation and part collection, and the full billing option, which is the one that we settled for. And so those options are still there. We can just dart off the paper and give you that to in preparation. Yeah, we can certainly resurface it. Right. But maybe you'll have to give us a date, because that on its own is a day agenda item.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think we'll process that.
All right. Some of the lessons, Chair, that I probably would like to share around the lead by example. Firstly, is the work that we have exposed our people to in the international arena. As members would be aware, I mean, we've developed expertise in auditing in the global space. In fact, 2 days ago, the reports of the United Nations Board of Auditors were presented at the General Assembly in New York, which were reports that we were part of delivering over the last 12 years. In fact, there were some notable positive comments at that stage, you know, in respect of what we have contributed and so on and so on. We've also sponsored on behalf of INTOSAI an adoption of a resolution. When current AG, as the chair of INCOSAI, he sponsored a resolution on the independence of global supreme audit institutions, which was adopted at the General Assembly last year, and he's busy processing it now through the AU, among others. I think on the global front, those are some of the very specific things that we have helped in developing, to say that each and every country in the world ought to adopt the standards of INTOSAI when it comes to the independence. Particularly in the continent, one of the things we have diagnosed as we were at the helm of the African chapter of audit institutions was the absence of independent institutions in other countries, which frustrates the ability of internal auditors to do their work effectively. So that was the essence of what we had sponsored in terms of leading by example, and among other things, to say if any of these entities in the continent or countries that are funded through global funding, among others, global donor organizations, if they don't have the legal support for the independence of the audit office, some of those funds may never find their way to places where they are supposed to go, because the funders and the donors will insist on getting credible institutions to do audit and to oversee those ones. So that was, I think, for us an important contribution while we had been involved in INTOSAI that we had made. It's now something that is trying to find its way into the agenda of AU after it was adopted in the UN. The other one, Chair, in terms of... Yes.
us to get this last input in writing?
It's already in the annual report. We have the actual resolution itself in our annual report, the one we were discussing 3 weeks ago. We've actually reprinted the full document on the head, on the UN GA resolution. So we have it comprehensively printed in the annual report. And certainly on the lead by example, Chair, if you also must think the other things that we did, the footprint for our people who had been involved in this audit. We think that we've gained a lot of experience, among others, in influencing the access to international work, because typically other audit offices do not have access to this international work, and I think our people have grown, among others, in terms of this. The fact that we are able to report on our mandate, Chair, since the AG and the previous one had been at the helm, we've been able to report fully and brought closer the area of accountability to those that are charged with oversight. I think what remains is the issues that need to be dealt with. The technical and learning development unit that we have put in place is an attempt to continue to drive the office as a reliable repository of technical understanding when it comes to financial management issues broadly, not only just within national government but also in municipalities. You will note that, among others, both in terms of the policies and the procedures that we develop, we've also in the past 4 or 5 years managed to cover every single municipality in all 9 provinces on the door-to-door, physically engaging with the municipal councils, the mayors and the CFOs on exactly the themes that have been coming out in our general reports. So we think all of this that has been done is clearly an indication of a firm foundation for doing a lot more of this, but also consolidating good governance in the public sector. We haven't had an annotation on our audit report, at least in the last 10 years, I think. But we've also come from a situation where we were in the red up to 2009 in terms of the financial fortunes of the institution. And that was something for us which was a worry, because the longer we wait for getting the money that we need to use to do the stuff that we do, the more difficult it will be to achieve the stuff that's set out for us in the law. So the fact that we've turned the corner and we were able to make some surpluses to us creates a better comforting environment, because we don't have to go and ask anybody else for resources to do what we do. And that strengthens our ability to claim independence when it comes to finance side of things. I think I have covered the number of questions, Chair. If I have missed out anything, we can pick it up, I'm sure, as we go forward. But let me pause at this stage, Chair, and see if there's anything else as a follow-up. But thanks for the clarification. Let me then race through the presentation as I set it out, starting from page 7. This is really the stuff that we committing to in terms of what's in the strat plan. The document which is headed Simplicity, Clarity and Relevance of Our Message, which is chapter 1, rather goal 1. All that's contained in those 3 pages, Chair, is effectively the same level of commitment that we have made. If you look at the table that says target 3, 3, 3. We measure ourselves on a scale of 1 to 4. And we have defined what 1 is, what 2 is, what 3 is, and what 4 is in terms of the detail of it. And so what we've said here is that insofar as continuing to provide clear messages and making recommendations to both PFMA and MFMA audits, we will try and strive to do that to the extent of no less than 75% of the total of the things we've got. So that's what the 3 is, which is a 3 out of a measure of 1 to 4. So we said we're not going to strike for a 4 out of 4, otherwise you will wrap us over the knuckles if you come here and we got 92% instead of 100. So we kind of said the number of things that we are learning insofar as making sure that the technical jargon, that's what we're trying to do here, we're continuously improving on how we communicate, because we've expanded the base of the stakeholders that we write these reports for. It's not just accountants, it's accountants and many other people who may not easily grasp what we are saying. So, yes, yes. So this is really an attempt to perfect the ability to reach across multiple stakeholders, you know, on the same page, as it were, without having to rewrite the same stuff because of different stakeholders. So that's really what we're committing to. And we're saying the measure for this is what we're going to be doing as a top-down feedback. We've got a process internally where we read the reports, you know, from AG, myself, and the executives. When we read them with a view to saying how many of the different stakeholders will understand what we're trying to say. If we say there are deficiencies in leadership, does that talk to the people in the organization? Does it talk to people in oversight? Does it talk to the external member of the public who comes across our report? So that all three of those variety of stakeholders can relate to the same message that we're talking about. So that's the commitment we're making, because we continuously say, as we identify the weaknesses in the report that we audit, we continuously go deeper and ask the why until we get to what the final root cause is. And that's exactly what we're committing to. It comes with a number of initiatives as per page 9, which are the specific and primary focus areas. The key initiatives that I spoke to earlier on, for example, was the increase in the volume of performance audits to 10% over a 5-year period. This is a journey that combines delivering the work as we are doing now in terms of this, but at the same time putting an angle to growing the skills simultaneously. Constant proactive evaluation of fraud risks. There's a number of instances where we audit, and we know that the level of assurance that we give as auditors is less than perfect, because if you read the fine print of an audit report, it always comes to a conclusion about fair presentation. Now, fair presentation is not 100%. It's about under a number of circumstances that are material. We think that you can rely on what you see. Please don't ask us about stuff that you know I don't know which we didn't come across if it's not too big enough for us to worry about. That's effectively what an audit report is, because people tend to read into it. If somebody says this is a clean audit, they tend to read that it means that it is free from all sorts of defects, whereas that's not really what it is. All it says is that an institution that is clean is likely to have the capacity to bounce back should any of its controls fall behind. An example, a clean institution, if it is attacked by somebody who defrauds payroll, it's an institution that's at the level that it will not take them more than a reasonable amount of time to detect that, but at the same time, it won't take them too long to fix it. So that's the level of assurance of what a clean audit is. It's not about we've looked at all of this, there is nobody who's interfered with anything. Of course, there is somebody who's interfered with something. The issue is that it may not have been so big enough in a department of 20 billion expenditure to warrant further tests if it was 450,000, for example. So we'll continue to do that and make sure that that message is clear, because we've also detected that the attachment of clean to an audit lends itself to all sorts of broad interpretations. To the extent that we've picked it up in local government, when we reported, if you recall, members, the 5% achievement of clean audits in municipalities, then suddenly people brought in a number of interpretations to that statement, you know, to say, how can you say this one is also clean because I know of
in the tender
that was awarded to somebody that I was contesting with, you know.
And no one
didn't pick that up, yes. Absolutely. And of course, if you start articulating the words in the audit report, you say, in all material respects, the financial statements present fairly. It says that to the extent that you are prepared to go to jail for the other 20% that we have not reported on, the 20% that you know about the tender that was given to somebody inappropriately, we are happy that whoever reads these financial statements will not be misled inappropriately. So that's the kind of commitment that we make to continue to...
It makes sense, but I can't remember my fingers. I think, Chair, this is a journey that we need to go through at pace, because many times we have to engage with this part. I mean, it's very interesting stuff that we get, and I think some of it is valuable input, because there's a number of people, either some of them have got an orientation in philosophy and all of those things, but the bottom line is the level of assurance coming from an auditor is never going to be at a level where you can then give it 100%. Because in a particular municipality, in a far-flung area, I could be the guy that owns a fleet of trucks, and I'm the municipal manager. I can go to the guy who runs the service station in the small town and have an account, but then the processing of the payments does not come from my bank account. It may come from the account of the municipality that I'm municipal manager or mayor of. So if I've got those illicit tendencies to divert resources of an institution towards my staff, I can assign an account to that garage. But the owner of the service station, when they see the municipality audit report, they will know that part of what this Auditor General report says, when it says it's clean, is inclusive of those payments that have been going to the municipal manager's fleet of trucks in my garage. He's a resident of this municipality. He knows this because he's perpetrated the collusion in this activity. He knows it. So when he reads that report, which potentially could be saying that the municipality is clean, he could easily laugh it off because he knows the specific facts around it. But he can't fault us for not having picked up the regular 820 rand times 12 petrol bill. Mm. Because it will probably be too small in the context of that 75 million municipality that we are reporting on. That's the kind of stuff which most people reading the annual report and financial statements will not be alive to.
Chairpersons were calling for a naming and shaming, that the Auditor General must stand on a podium and start reading out a list of offenders with specific amounts to the extent that they have offended, almost like a court. And there was a bit of a tension because the Auditor General said it was not within his... So we may need to say, well, it may not be our job, but what do we recommend is the best solution to satisfy this desire and deal with this frustration that people are having? But how can the audit report assist us to get to a point where we can zoom into serious corruption issues and begin to engage them head on as a parliament and so on and so on. Just to assist people with understanding the system and how it works and how the coordination and the linkages actually get forged with the SIUs and the prosecuting authority, who would be in a position to actually do proper criminal investigation and take the matter to court. Something of that nature without any detail.
Now, if I progress quickly to the next goal, and that one is also contained on the goal 2 of the slide, the next 4 pages that we will go through. Same measure of achievement here, to say at least to the extent that there are 3 times doing this better out of the 4 possible. And again, here we're focusing on a number of initiatives,
focusing on a number of initiatives here, which is about increasing the level of rigor. And one of the things here, Chair, which was taken into account under the visibility of Leadership One, we've taken note of the fact that, and I'm sure all of us and a lot of the members of the public would relate to the series of interactions that have taken place, whether on radio, on television, via the report itself, via the door-to-door campaign, as well as the roadshow campaign, which is currently underway now as we speak. This area, we're saying, we want to bring closer to these institutions our understanding and insights, as well as to possibly encourage and influence them to account for and to deal with matters of financial management appropriately, so that we can help remove the cloud that sits behind some of the stuff that may be done well. I mean, there's no doubt a number of things that could potentially be good examples or good outcomes of what has been done, but for as long as people do not take serious cognizance of clearing audit outcomes, it clouds whatever it is that they are doing, because people will remember the fact that they were explained or they were qualified, and they will never bring about their confidence. So this is where we try to drive what we have in our reputation promise, which is about doing financial accountability, transparency and governance with a view to driving public confidence. So here, interactions and influences that we bring about as well is also widening the circle of engagement. That's why when we come to Parliament, we don't only engage with SCOBA, but we engage with a wide range of other committees, because we think that more levels of oversight and governance over this will probably make the journey shorter over time. So that's really where we put our effort, and that's where the bulk of the audit office will either be in provinces doing work to encourage cleaning up of audit issues. National Treasury fits into this part of the chapter, because we would also interact with and engage with a number of governance forums, including National Treasury, including the Office of the Public Service Commission if it comes to issues of human resource capacity in government, or legislatures, as well as the secretaries of different legislatures. So those are the number of networks that we've developed over time. And in terms of this year, we said, let us see whether over the last 6 years' efforts, we can start drawing them down to an institutionalized mechanism and consolidate them and make sure that we don't go on this path without taking stock of what we've achieved over time, so that when we build plans for the subsequent years, at least we would have taken cognizance of what we've achieved now. So there's a lot of elements of trying to consolidate this and bring it together, so that we can also start saying, we have been going through this journey with all oversight structures. This is our observation of what's preventing it from becoming effective to the level desired. So that's one of the things Chair will be looking at. And AG, over the next year and a bit, will probably also be spending a lot more time than in the parliamentary environment to start sharing some insights from the journey we've been on around the elections for oversight. And he brings, again, into that equation some of the stuff that he has picked up as he has been doing in the InterSight community as well.
This issue relates to what Honorable Shoppers told. I must call her correctly now before she lynched me. Raised earlier on about capacity. Well, then we're focusing on internal audit institutions, but broader in terms of performance, capacity of, in terms of skills in the public service. There was a question in Parliament this week to the relevant ministers about this CETA versus Palama, which is and the creation of a school of governance within government. I think that all those issues, we need to be involved there, because one of the key areas of competence is this one. And we need to really influence the emphasis and the focus of all these attempts to improve capacity and skilling in the public service, to say insofar as this area, which is really at the heart of good governance, we really need to come strongly to say that that school of governance must have a dedicated focus. Or it alternatively, it must partner with relevant structures such as yourself in modeling what would be the ideal kind of training programs and so on.
Chair, also to add to that, at some stage I think the AG gave us something on, if I'm not mistaken, it was four pillars or something like that in relation to areas to focus on on governance issues in particular and leadership management. Now, the issue is that we constantly and continuously and also almost deliberately, I'd say, defocus ourselves from what the issues are in terms of the type of capacity that we need to build. Because if we had to be realistic, taking the courses that you'd go through with Palama, how many of those courses would, for example, look at audit issues of where we constantly have a cry about, including ourselves in Parliament? And at the end of the day, we don't end up coming to a point where we say these cross-cutting issues must be like almost like a pyramid. They must be kept, and with a particular time frame, so that we can start seeing where there's an improvement in terms of our capacity development overall in the public service. Because it's part of the areas that if we don't improve in terms of training, we will continuously say the Auditor General would then come with a negative report. So we also refuse to cap these issues and do it effectively, to say that we have identified these, there's 10 areas, there's 12 areas, there's 15 areas, whatever the case is, from Palama or the training institutions to the public service, to the Auditor General, to whoever is going to be involved in the commissions. We are all focusing on this. We are not getting to that point. So for as long as we don't get to that point of capping these areas of capacity building, I think we'll continue to because we might find in a situation where the very Palama has one set of focus areas, CETA has another. All CETA is worried about, after all, is them claiming the funds that are relevant for themselves, and the Auditor General has another.
I think we might just tighten the formulation of our
recommendations around these issues in our report, so that when we report to the Assembly, we make very sharp and very focused recommendations and look at following them up as well as part of our contribution towards the bigger pool of issues and discourses around improving governance in the country. All right.
Sufficient reserves to continue to plant back into the institution, because we've got a lot of issues. I mean, the environment we work in also requires us to reinvest regularly on things like your up-to-date IT equipment and so on. For example, among other examples, we've recently signed up to install telecommunication conference facilities, as an example, in all our 9 offices, in fact, all 12 of them, including Parliament, including the National Head Office, with a view to allowing people the opportunity to first decide if they really need to go to Mpumalanga physically to have this, to
to our meeting covering what needs to be done, or should they not, as a team sitting in Gauteng, also interact with people in Northwest and Mpumalanga simultaneously? So that's the kind of investment we have not had an opportunity to put money into in the past, because we had very light surpluses. So it's things like those that we're going to be escalating the growth in our investment. But on the other hand, the area of performance audit, because we are in a building phase, nobody else is going to fund that heavy investment part of it. Because for us, the ability to fund anything, we've got to charge for it. So we haven't got a product yet to give to anybody who will in turn pay for it. So there'll be an element of us having to absorb that investment as we grow our capacity to have performance audits. Otherwise, it may never come if we're going to wait for somebody to first pay before they... I mean, some of them were starting to query, why are you wanting us to pay for this, because you just came and did it, and it's now also reflecting not so well on us. So you also want us to pay you, but at the same time you are saying all these things that are not working in our environment for something that we are not statutorily obliged to do every year. It's unlike a statutory audit where there's a statute that says you must do it. But if I want to come and do a performance audit on the extent of vacancies, let's say at Home Affairs, or if I want to go and do a statutory, or rather a performance audit on the effectiveness of producing ID documents, Home Affairs has a right to say, sorry, we're not going to allow you to do that because of whatever reason. So it's something that is a bit tricky, because there's a discretionary element to accepting the assignment. That's why then an investment will fall in our lab for some of the developmental parts of this. So as far as the finances are concerned, then, Chair, it's a question of doing the rebuilding, as well as to make sure that the sufficient infrastructure in place for this to continue, because the more there's going to be changes in the future, the more we're going to need to rely on institutionalized information. And then on the human resource side of things, the one key thing that we are intensifying the focus on in terms of the fourth goal is the intensifying of training and skills. We realize that the audit office, for quite a number of years, has relied largely on people coming from the public service. If one looks at the growth and the development of the audit office over a number of years, prior to the 90s and so on, people had come from the likes of your Department of Home Affairs, your Department of State Expenditure, your Department of Finance as well, those days. But we no longer have that channel now, so we kind of take people raw. If one looks at the structure of our training and training contract of the training accountants, we get people raw from a technical institution who have learned auditing and accounting. And here the focus here is to make sure that at least we can broaden the skills base across the country, so that the natural change and the natural attrition in the office doesn't get us to a state where we have a shortage of people with the right public sector financial auditing skills. In the same way, the development of our leadership pipeline is also driven by those requirements. Now, I think, Chair, what I'll do, I'll ask the CFO to deal with the specific finance issues of focus which are in here, before I go down to the lead by example chapter, which is the last one. So Raj, can I ask you to then go straight to the section that says budget, which is behind page 28 of the presentation. Then I'll come back and deal with the last chapter on the leading by example. Over to you, Raj.
Thank you, DAG. Honorable members, the budget 13-14, DAG has mentioned, we are budgeting a 1% surplus, which amounts to 25 million rand of turnover, as opposed to the previous year when we budgeted a 2% surplus, which amounted to 46 million rand. Our gross profit percentage remains static at 31%. The work allocated to private audit firms represents 25% of our revenue. We are increasing our bad debt provision by 15 million rand, and there was an earlier question that dealt specifically with the debtor scenario, which I'll come back to at the end of this presentation. Learning and development, which is a core focus area of the office, that's increasing by 26 million rand. Technological services, which is mainly our ICT environment, that's planned to increase by 15 million rand. The salary increase for the year on average is budgeted at 8.1%, but the tariff increase, our charge out rates of the audit fees to our auditees is planned to go up by 5.7%. We are growing our headcount in the audit area of the business by about 144 people. And the total recoverable hours that we intend to grow by is about 200,000 hours. And that's due to the additional audit activities out in the field. Now, going to page 32, which gives us a high-level overview of the income statement. The revenue year on year, last year was 2.2 billion, and that's going to grow to around about 2.5 billion for the 13-14 year. Our direct costs are in line with the previous year in terms of percentages, and our gross profit for the year is going to be 773 million. The expenses year on year is going to grow from 707,000 to 707 million to 828 million. And as I said at my opening comments, the surplus planned for the year is 25 million. So that's a high-level overview of the income statement, honorable members. And what we've done in the next slide on 33, which is just something we want to highlight, is that we've now broken up our revenue in terms of between regulatory audit, specialized audit, which is something we've been talking about quite a lot in terms of performance auditing, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that gives us a pretty good reflection in terms of our concentration of activities, 1.6 billion to 218 million. The gross profit percentage, as I said earlier, remains static at 31%. On slide number 35, which deals with the overhead analysis, it basically breaks down for us some of the major cost components that makes up the 828 million I referred to earlier. And as we can see, we've got staff remuneration in support of 255 million. That's a big one. Learning and development, which I said earlier is a core area of ours, a core focus area of 108 million. And then on technological services, there's an investment of 55 million, and it's an area of the business that has been neglected in the past. So it's time we've invested quite heavily in that area, as we are largely an ICT-driven environment. Even our audits are performed using electronic audit software. On page slide 36, depreciation you would see has gone up from 40 million to 47 million. And again, that talks to our investment in technology primarily that's driving that kind of growth. I'm just going through the high-level cost structures. I think the last slide, page slide 838, honourable members, is that just unpacks for us the other cost drivers for the 828 million, and as we can see there, that there's no significant year-on-year movement between the budgets. So, DHE, that kind of concludes a high-level overview of the financial numbers. I'm not sure, DHE, if at this point I should talk to the specific question on the debtors that was raised earlier. Thank you. Honourable members, the question around the debtors, our problem is centred around local government auditees, mainly the municipalities. And we did a five-year analysis, and what we've realised is that the amount of debtors outstanding over the last five-year period grew from 101 million to 206 million. So it's basically doubled over a five-year period. The problematic provinces are mainly Northwest, Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, Free State, and Limpopo. Right. The bad debt provision for the last financial year was increased from 45 million to 74 million. That's 29 million rand, just to sort of provide for the slow-paying debtors that we're experiencing with local government auditees. So there's been a significant growth in provision, and I think that's been done to just compensate for the potential. Between 2011 and 2012, our debtors grew from 399 million to 480 million overall, with all categories of debtors. So that was a growth of about 81 million rand. The intervention that SCOAG had asked us to pursue some years ago has been implemented over the last few years, and that is the charging of interest on outstanding debt, and it has had some positive impact, although the collection challenges still persist in certain provinces, as I've highlighted earlier. So that's a high-level overview of where we stand on the debtors at this point.
All right. That's the financial part of the document, honourable members. Then the last chapter, which is the leading by example, is our commitment once again to do the right stuff in respect of making sure that when we have to report to the committee, we report firstly a clean audit. We're still committing to achieving that in our strat plan. We have also acknowledged the fact that we do also sometimes slip up on certain things, but we want to assure the committee that when that happens, we will continue to demonstrate that we can bounce back and fix the things that are potentially deterioration in our controls. That's effectively what this chapter says, yeah. And also the intensification of the ethics program in the office, which is, I think, I'm reading now on page 23, continuous and consistent quality work, which is a reflection on the competence that we require as well as the technical ability. And that's why a lot of our efforts are linked to these goals, to say the best possible way that we can get to this level of strong technical competence
is if we continue to train and to expose our people to broader environments. Sharing of information with other related institutions, as well as working with them on very clear and guided principles insofar as the pursuit of oversight work is concerned. Then as far as the measures are concerned, honorable members, on page 24, the standards of excellence that we commit to adhere to in order to achieve clean administration will for us largely be measured by the attestation that comes with our audit report, which according to where we are now, we would like to believe that it must be clean and nothing less. So we're committing to achieve that clean audit report on an ongoing basis. Another one, in terms of the second line of continuous improvement, is the commitment to always have our threat plan, budget, annual report, and all the general reports within the agreed timelines, and that's why we are putting a target of 1%. We're saying here that we are planning not to slip on the expected statutory deadlines for those reports. And as far as the PFMA and the MFMA audit reports, where we're committing 90% of what the total target ought to be, is in recognition of the fact that some of the institutions simply just do not submit on time. So we take that into account and saying at least if we can achieve anything, let's try and achieve a compliance level of 90%. And this means if an institution is required, in the PFMA as an example, they submit their financial statements at the end of May for us to audit, and we are supposed to issue our audit reports on the 31st of July. There are instances where some of them come forward. For example, an example of this, Home Affairs reported the other day, but the reporting date was end of July, as an example, because there were certain glitches they needed to deal with before they could finalize it. So when we set this target, we take into account those things that we do not yet know that may trip us when it comes to the final reporting stage. Ideally, everybody should be giving their report to us by the deadline date, and we're supposed to be issuing an audit report for all of them by the 31st of July, as articulated in the statutes and the PFMA. But the reality of life is that there are always those out of 10, one or two of them that may not necessarily meet that. Our contribution to transformation, this largely lends itself to the work that we dish out to the private audit firms. We've taken a view that we want to contribute to the growth, particularly of small and emerging black firms, among others, who do work on behalf of the Auditor General. So this angle here and this objective is our commitment to continue to support the growth of the emerging firms of professionals. And I'm sure we've seen over the last couple of years, at least in the last 2 to 3 years, there's now suddenly emerged a very strong set of firms, among others, the likes of the merger that arose from the Sizwe Ntsaluba Kobodo, and there's a number of others that are already in consolidation mode. So there's a huge number of black audit firms that are consolidating their practices. And here we're saying we will continue to provide them work opportunities to grow. Initiatives on the lead by example is about strengthening our tools of trade, as it were, which is largely the IT environment, to enhance levels of communication by exploiting communication technology instead of having to be physically at a one-hour meeting 400 kilometers away, and then by the time you come back, the day is over and you've only spent 1 hour doing anything. So that's the kind of stuff that we say here, yeah, we want to lead by example. Let's rather not get out to the place, but make sure that what was intended to be achieved can be achieved without travel and so on. Sustainability of our operations. I spoke earlier about the kind of stuff we're going to be bringing to the committee to indicate that we are also starting to respond as an audit office by measuring, among others, things like establishing the baseline for various things that we do. For example, paper. The paper that we generate, we wanted to develop strategies around these things to say, would it not be better that we earmark the things that we will print for
if they are necessary. Otherwise, certain things we don't necessarily have to print for. We can pass on the obligation to the next person. They decide themselves if they want to print it or they want to read it electronically. But for us, these are some of the things that we're going to start putting in our integrated report. We've done the first one for the year that we just reported on, and we will continue on the journey to bring consciousness to our people on this as well, so that when they decide on their day-to-day activities, they are not driven by habit, but they are driven by certain specific goals that have been set. And that is the last one, Chair, to complete the five chapters on the commitments that the office makes. As I said, maybe when we have this engagement around this time next year, which will be at the tail end of the strategic plan that we have set for the past 7 years, there may well be a different conversation by a different person. Thank you.
Questions on this section of the presentation in terms of the specific issues? Yes, Honourable Pican.
Sure, no, I'm just interested in knowing in terms of the BBBEE firms that you mentioned, if you're able to rate yourself at 3 out of 4, I take it. Is the target rating? Yeah. On page 26. Now, I'm just interested in knowing, do you have a figure of the total number of firms that you'd normally be dealing with? And out of that total figure, how many are now your BEE companies? With the names of those companies?
The audit work which we do principally, if you look at the numbers in the income statement, the total amount of money that we are putting aside to dish out work that we don't do ourselves is way above 500 million in total, and that all registered audit firms in South Africa are eligible to participate for that. So if you look at the top four, for example, you've got Deloitte, PwC, KPMG, and then Young, followed by the likes of Kobodo and Gongi and all of them. So in total, we've got a database of about 48 in total, I think, which is pretty much the entire database of registered audit firms. A majority of those are your firms, medium-sized and the low-end. But we can provide the statistics just to share with you. We actually have put it in the annual report, but we can pick it up again if you need the specific firm names.
No, the reason I was asking that, Chair, is just to also determine the level of empowerment that you're also engaged in or involved in, especially when you have to go to the smaller municipalities. And coming back to the point that you made about not necessarily having to go to a particular area, but if there is a qualifying firm within that area, you can then carry out that audit, and then you have your way of communicating could help the effective costing as well. So I was just looking at whether your, in terms of your rating yourself, is what do you say? In terms of the number of firms, I mean the smaller firms normally, you'd find that there's a hickle or hassle here and there for you to select them, which then enforces you to go in and select the big firms. And hence I was interested in knowing in terms of your ratios to that.
This rating here is normally what is given to us by an external agency on how we have conducted ourselves in line with the transformation objectives. Yes. But insofar as the firms are concerned, I think it probably is one of those lucky things that I would say is probably just something that falls on our lap by virtue of the structure of the audit firms in the country. You'll find, for example, a lot of the big prominent ones, the ones that audit JSE listed companies, the likes of Deloitte, PwC and so on, Their footprint is predominantly largely in the urban, semi-urban environments. When we have to deal with an audit that is in Port Norlock, you'll probably find that there's a smaller practitioner in Port Norlock who we will use for that purpose. So I guess we are lucky in the sense that we end up finding the ones that we ought to be using in the far-flung areas, places like Kimberley, like East London, and Northwest, and all of those places. So we will normally find that the big firms are not present there. And one of the principles that we use is that we will give a firm that has got a footprint in a particular area. If Deloitte only has offices in KZN, Gauteng, Western Cape, and so on, and do not have a presence in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, we won't allocate work to them there, because we don't want them to bring people from Gauteng to Mpumalanga when there are firms in Mpumalanga who can do that work for us, because they've also possessed the same competence to do it. So when we're in Mpumalanga and the big players are not there, we normally find the black firms there on the ground who are doing it. So hence I'm saying that there's an element of luck as well for us.
We don't get into the problem of conflict of interest, because I recall when one firm that was going to
us got into a merger, we had to change auditors because of issues of obviously, because the other firm that was a partner in the merger was actually doing work for us, so that was going to be a conflict of interest in terms of the relationship. How did we say we manage those kind of dynamics if all of them are on the database for receiving work from us?
Every year, Chair, we've got a set of principles that we use to allocate work for all these firms. And so every 2 years, we do an allocation, and we send out the request for proposals, and each one of them submits their proposals. And internally, when we do evaluate the tender process, we look at such issues as capacity, quality, conflict of interest, and certain declarations and disclosures that they must make, so that before we can issue a specific audit to any of the firms, we've already covered those issues. So there's a proactive process as part of the supply chain to make sure that no inappropriate conflict of interest are allowed to encroach into the delivery of work. Then, of course, like any other system, systems generally will always be dependent on the effectiveness with which the people overseeing them do their work. But from time to time, there are elements of feedback that come to us which indicate, among others, that there may be elements of encroaching conflict of interest with some of the service providers. We've got a mechanism to communicate with those. For example, this past Monday, there were certain questions like those when we had an interaction with SALGA and the respective provinces on the MFMA audit. Some of the guys from the municipalities were making those kind of suggestions to say they see some of the people doing work on our behalf could potentially be conflicted. Now, the elements of this management of the conflict of interest that is not entirely in our hands is situations that they described, among others. One of them was a situation where this particular firm was pitching for work before they were auditors were used by us for that institution. So they will go and pitch for work directly, which is normally the consulting work where they wanted to do consulting services for that particular municipality. And then they get turned down. And then, for some luck, then they happen to be allocated work by us. Remember, they have not been engaged by that municipality, so they don't have an existing conflict in the sense that they haven't done work for them, which they are now coming back to audit. So the point that some of these municipalities were raising was that, is that or is that not a conflict of interest, that a person who was pitching for work with us did not get successful, but then subsequently, under the normal allocation of work by us, they then get allocated work by us.
And then they get a claim and then they say, well,
that was a revenge. It was a revenge because they didn't win work from us, and so they are coming here now with a different head. Well, we said to those situations, give us the specific examples, we'll be able to pick up if there was an element of abuse in this or whatever. But typically, I think if I was a CFO and somebody I rejected and comes now to audit me and I happen to end up with a disclaimer, I'll probably think that they were influenced by the loss of the contract work and they are coming guns blazing now as auditors. So those are the kind of questions that we get. So we don't sit back and do nothing about them. The point, I think, is that sometimes people read something else into that relationship. And so we do have a system and an ethics unit, for that matter, that canvasses ethical matters internally as far as our people are concerned. But as far as the firms are concerned, there's a line of communication between executives responsible for that audit and the firm.
Which leads to another question. Is there a grievance stroke appeal mechanism where auditees are aggrieved with your findings? Whether the tariff that they've been, not the tariff, but the actual invoices that they've been given, where they may want to dispute the cost or the outcome, the audit outcome, or the process that was followed, whichever grievance they might have. How do you deal with those issues?
Chair, there are provisions that are set out in respect of a complaints procedure in the Public Audit Act. But I think it's a fact the utilization of those provisions is largely, in my view, a factor of the maturity of the system in dealing with those issues, because ultimately it ends up being a yo-yo ball at the end, you know, where the one says, but the reason I spent this extra 20 hours is because you delayed us on the audit. So the auditees tend to be reluctant when they've got a contestation to bring it forward, because there's a lot of issues that are partly their culpability, among others as well, when it comes to issues of contesting fees. Because I think if you look at the transversal staff that sits in some of the municipalities in particular, is lack of access to people who will make representations for the audit, lack of access to documentation to substantiate transactions. So the combination of those things tend to create a field conflict between management and the auditors. And by the time anyone wants to put a lodge, a formal complaint, they know that they are partly responsible for it. So the reality is that they seldom come forward with those, even though we know sometimes that they are probably within their right to do it. But they seldom come forward because they know that they will be reminded of those instances that they promised to provide. Yeah. So that's the challenge. I think it's a factor of maturity. But the principle itself is there in terms of being utilized in law. It's just that we're dealing with a situation where there's all sorts of counter accusations about who's responsible.
And that's charging them more because in the process, you need some more information that you had not picked up.
I don't know, colleagues, if there are any further questions. I think what we'll do is that the research unit will work on those things, will prepare a draft report, and then when we meet next round, obviously we'll start with the other reports that we need to deal with. I will schedule for next week, Friday. And then we must expedite finalizing the draft on this one as well, because the year is coming to an end. But all those issues we'll deal with administratively. I don't know if there are any other administrative and other issues, announcements. Yes, DG.
Just one more point from us, Chair. The Honorable Stian Hazen.
Yes.
Through the committee chair, if there are any further questions that you wanted to canvass on the funding side, it would help us if we could, through you, forward them to us so that when you come next week, we can at least deal with them comprehensively. I got a sense that he's got a number of other questions he wanted to deal with, and so because he left before we got to that part, we will be happy to entertain those and bring some firm answers.
Thank you.
Could you, committee secretary, just convey to him that he can follow up in writing, and the committee section will forward his further questions and any other members' questions directly to the AG's office. Secretary is inquiring about the audit directive. Is it something that we're supposed to be traversing today as well?
Oh, yeah, Chair, sorry about that. The
audit directive in terms of Section 13 of the PAA. This audit directive, Chair, as a reminder again to the committee, is one of the things that we do a consultation for purposes of approval by the committee. This is where we set out once again the standards to which we audit, the scope and nature of our audits, so that we can engage COWEG on them. So effectively, the current directive that we audited to, which was submitted in November 2011, remains in force. So effectively, it's a question of dusting off that previous submission that we made, which came out as part of this gazette, 34783, and confirm that we are using it. There's no significant changes to the scope of work that we do, as well as the standards to which we audit. So we effectively will also table that directive together with the strat plan as an unchanged document from the previous time.
Can I say that at some point
we may need to have a structured training program for ourselves as a committee where we can learn at a more technical level and understand better some of these tools, like the audit directive, like all these international standards on which our audit directives are actually based or derived, so that we ourselves have a sense of empowerment. Because when we do the oversight visits, we find that we learn more and we get to understand the institution in a much more concrete way. For example, this whole thing about GRAP, around infrastructure management tool and so on. It became a lot more clear and vivid when we're visiting municipalities, and the issue was constantly raised to say, if a municipality does not have a clear projection as to what infrastructure it requires, what is the lifespan of that infrastructure, what maintenance implications are involved, budget cost, it's right up to a point of its scrapping and placement and those kind of. Those are fascinating eye-openers, and I think more of that kind of stuff, or issues of basic accounting and bookkeeping, just to understand the system concretely so that we can relate to these issues at a less theoretical and more concrete level. I think it would also enhance our capacity to do oversight on the institution and play the supportive role that we're supposed to play. I know that what are those workshops that we have regularly with Scopus? APEC workshops are very helpful, but maybe we could look at a more dedicated program where not only us, maybe even portfolio committees could join in, because they're not exposed in the first place to APEC, and that's part of the problem, I think. Only Scopa seems to be the masters of this thing.
All right, yes, DAG.
No, Chair, we'll take that into account, and it will help us a great deal if you could also give us guidance on the how part of this. Yeah, because so that
we'll think through it and possibly interact and with you
please take into consideration the fact that with us being in other committees, it does affect our availability, and some of us are becoming desperate.
That's why I'm thinking of
come back to these issues when we deal with the draft report that shall have been presented to us from the research unit. On that note, thank you very much, everybody. Have a safe trip home and enjoy your weekend. We'll see you next Friday. Sure. Perfect time to end the meeting.